My first guest is Heber Mayor Colleen Potter. Thank you for calling in, Colleen.
You're welcome.
Yeah, they're great. Hey, so let's start off by going over the recent Heber Light and Power meeting this past week. There was a call out by the grassroots organization known as Volt for people to show up to give input. Could you first start off by reminding us what Volt is?
It is a group of citizens, and Volt is an acronym for Valleywide Opposition to Large Transmission Lines. And they have rallied together after a section of the new power line was put in on 40 as you come into Heber. And they gathered together a petition, and a lot of citizens started to get involved in trying to figure out where this what's happening with the future of the project and what can be done to mitigate the impact that it's having on our valley.
So there was also on the agenda a possible transmission pole configuration decision. Did that happen? And what is
there
that?
There was one section that was sort of was looked at by our facilities committee, and they reported back. And this section is the north end. It's the very north end of the project, which would end up connecting to the Rocky Mountain Power section up at Jordanelle. And it is going to be similar to what we see, but the facilities committee had determined that if we bury the underbuild, and the underbuild is like the communication lines, the distribution lines, it would make the poles a little shorter and a little less, a little less, I guess the word is ugly. Everybody thinks they're so awful. But anyway, it just makes it look a little bit less noticeable. So anyway, that is the recommendation of Facilities Committee, is to move forward on that section with some of these, changes to make it a little less noticeable. And the Facilities Committee will continue to meet. I think they meet again next week to look at the other sections as they move down further into the valley.
And who makes up the Facilities Committee?
Well, we have a 6-member board, and there are 3 members on that facilities committee. It's County Councilman Kendall Crittenden, City Council Member Wayne Hardman, and Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson.
Okay. And then what kind of public input did you receive?
Well, we did have a lot of, not a lot, but we had a handful of members of the public at this meeting, and their concern at that point, obviously there are a lot of people who this will impact, and they already have these power lines, but they're concerned about how big are they really going to be? What are the easements? When will they exactly they know what the plan is? And those were some of the questions that came up. And we had an open discussion in the meeting and allowed the public to talk about it. And our staff, the way this project works is there's sort of this big picture. Yes, we need the line, and where's it going to go? But the details aren't really worked out until after the permit is issued and then the engineering takes place and the size of the poles and exactly where they're going to be located will be done on a pole-by-pole basis. So naturally, the people are concerned there was someone there who said that, this easement will go right into their kitchen. And so I totally understand their concern, and I'm hoping that as we move forward, we can get them more information. We can try to work this out in a way that, although it's not desirable, ultimately that it's something that, we have to have the power. So anyway, we're just moving forward, trying to work out all the details.
And is the idea of burying those lines completely out of the picture, is it just too cost prohibitive? Or
it's not out of the picture entirely, but the idea of burying all of the lines is out of the picture. It's just the cost is just too high, and there's not support on the board for that. But particularly Mayor Johnson and I are still trying to push to say, are there sections that we can bury? What are the most, what are the most offensive sections? Interestingly, it seems to just come down to different opinions, because some people think, you cannot have those poles in the North Fields. It's such a beautiful view for our valley. You need to bury that section. Well, I was speaking to the Rotary group this week, and several people said, it doesn't matter in the North Fields. Just get them far out. But you cannot have those poles in the neighborhood. You got to bury the sections in the neighborhood. So we're just hearing, and then we have other people saying, it's not a big deal. They're just poles. No one, over time, people don't notice them anymore. It's not worth creating a new tax. So we really have a lot of different opinions all across the spectrum.
Yeah, so can you also just kind of remind listeners where the power is going? Because Rocky Mountain Power wants to close this loop of power, connecting Parley's Canyon, my understanding is, with the Provo Canyon. And will the benefits of having those additional high power transmission lines, will the benefits be seen in the Heber Valley as well?
Well, the answer is yes and no. So Rocky Mountain Power does need to connect that loop, and it does help them serve their customers better and et cetera, et cetera. And what happened was years ago when they were planning to connect their loop, Heber Light and Power approached them and said, hey, why don't we do this together? Because it appeared that Rocky Mountain Power would do what they're going to do regardless of what Heber Light and Power did. And Heber Light and Power does need to improve. We do need to rebuild our south line, and we also need a second point of interconnect. Everything that we've seen as far as public policy from the legislature, as far as case law, it appears that Rocky Mountain Power can come through our valley whether it benefits us or not. And so it makes sense to previous boards and to this board to have one set of power lines through our valley, not two. So there's kind of a dual purpose. So we'll have one side of the line will be the Rocky Mountain Power line, and the other side of the pole will have the Heber Light Power line. So it benefits us in a big picture way that we get a second point of interconnect. They pay 80% of the project, but their power loop is not necessarily needed for our valley.
Okay. Let's move on and talk about the Heber bypass studies. How are they coming along? Were they supposed to be done by December? Is that the timeline on those?
They were. It looks like it'll be January. We wanted to reopen the survey. They had a QR code for the survey, and we're concerned that there were people that weren't able to access it, and so we've reopened it to the end of the month. So we're just going to bump the results back a little bit, probably January. We should have the recommendation from the planning study.
Okay. And then is there also you're waiting for some kind of authorization with the legislature this year to proceed. Is that right?
Well, what we'll need next after this planning study is a $2.5 million allocation from the legislature for the environmental study. So you have the planning study, and they say, yes, we've done all this research. We think this is a good alignment. But then the environmental study comes and says, well, you know, that's okay, or no, that's not okay. That's impacting the wetlands, or there's a, you know, some archaeological find. And that's why it costs so much money and takes a couple of years. So that's the next step in the process. We're hoping we can do that as quickly as possible, because until that happens, we really can't guarantee where it's going to go.
Is the only chance to get the $2.5 million allocated during the legislative session? Do you have that as a timeline, or?
Yes. That's what we're anticipating right now. But I guess I'm not aware of any other way to make that happen.
Okay. And what about the property? My understanding too is that Wasatch County has been acquiring property over the past number of years to actually do these to get the right of ways. Is that progressing, and where does that stand?
Yes. So over the years, the city and the county have been purchasing property or asking people to donate that, you know, sections of property. Sometimes when they annex to Heber City, there's been opportunities to get some property donated. At this point, we're probably, I don't know, around 50% or so of that property. And it's being purchased through corridor preservation funds, $10 that people pay when they do their car registration. We haven't actively pursued any more because we're in this process of determining where it's going to go. There is some concern that some of the property that's been acquired might not be the route that's approved in the environmental study. So there are a lot of moving parts, and we're just trying to move forward the best we can. But we don't have any property currently that we're looking at to purchase.
Okay.
And then we kind of get a little further in this study.
Sure. And then UDOT, is UDOT on board with the project?
Yes, UDOT has been part of this planning process.
Okay, great.
We're working together.
Okay, let's talk about the plan. What the update is with the Highway 40 Mill Road planning map. Are there any updates on that? There's some discussion about the developer is interested in changing the code, the planning map, so that they can do some residential development. And where does that stand at this point?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of which one you're talking about. Is it the Heber Meadows? Is that the one you're talking about?
I think it's the area. It's north of town on the Mill Road and 40.
Connection. Oh yes, okay. So north of town. You're talking about the VXC annexation. Sorry, we have so many.
Yes, and that isn't that where they're interested in changing the zoning from a commercial planning zone to residential?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about that area, and the council was sort of, some of the council members said we need more commercial there, and other council members said, well, we don't want commercial all along there. Then it went to the Planning Commission. And a lot of the neighbors said, we want no commercial there. And that was the most recent action was at the Planning Commission when the neighbors are saying they don't want residential. It's coming back, and I'm not sure where it's going to land. But it's a big area. There's a lot of open fields. Everyone loves looking at it. It's been purchased by a home builder, and there's just a lot of, it's still in play what it's going to eventually look like.
Okay, and is it near where the Sorensen UVU property sits?
Yes, it's closer to Heber City. It's on the north end of Heber, but it's before the Sorensen property, right before you get to that if you're heading north from Heber.
Okay, great. Anything else that you want to talk about going on with Heber business?
Well, one exciting thing is we're having our tree lighting ceremony on the 7th, and we're going to have an old-fashioned Christmas and light a big tree and hopefully get a bunch of people out for food trucks. And we built a new fire pit on the front of our city hall property, and we're just hoping to get more community together and get ready and celebrate the holidays.
Is this an outdoor activity, basically?
Yes, it's an outdoor activity on the city block, and then the block next to it will close off the Center Street from Main Street to First West, and there will be a lot of different activities and things for people to participate in. So hopefully the weather will cooperate, but we're excited about that.
I thought you also mentioned maybe there's a gingerbread house judging coming up soon.
Yes, so that is this weekend. This morning we're going to judge the houses, and then over today and tomorrow at our event center, people can come and see all of the gingerbread houses. This is a benefit for the Children's Justice Center. So people will purchase those. They're auctioned off, and that money goes to benefit the Children's Justice Center. There's entertainment. My daughter's actually clogging, and there's a bunch of other entertainment. Some Christmas trees, just whatever people donate, those will all be auctioned off. And then there's some little vendors there, too, as well. So it's a fun event.
And are the gingerbread houses made by local people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and some are incredible. There's always one made by the inmates at the jail, and it's phenomenal, the things that people can do with gingerbread and frosting and candy. So it's worth coming to see.
Okay, and where will that be?
That will be at the event center. It's the Wasatch County Event Center.
Okay, and it's over the weekend?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
Today and tomorrow.
Okay. And you have any hours on that, or?
You know, I am in my car, or I'd have a paper in front of me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I think today it starts around 10 or 11 and goes until evening. And same thing tomorrow. It's most of the day.
Okay. We'll look it up and get it out there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Anything else, Colleen, that you want to go over?
That's all I can think of right now.
Okay. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Good morning. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. News time is 8:30. I have Becca Gerber. She's the Park City Council member in to give us an update on last night's meeting. Thanks for coming by, Becca.
Good morning. What a beautiful morning it is.
Oh,
yay!
I know. Everybody's happy about this, right? Powder day. I know. So Becca, in regular session, the council attracted an audience, maybe 30 people or so. And I guess they came in for a couple of reasons. One had to do with support for the Lucky Ones coffee shop at the library, which gives jobs to people with differing abilities. And it sounds like it was a pretty feel-good occasion from the standpoint of just the success of this project and the testimony that was coming from customers. So how did this operation come about? Can you give us some background on that?
Well, really, Taylor and Katie came to us last, maybe even January, when we were discussing our social equity goals and mentioned that they were interested in opening up a coffee shop, employing neurodiverse and differently abled people in our community. And they submitted an RFP for the coffee shop at the library, and we were absolutely thrilled to have that come our way, and it sounded like a great opportunity for our community, and we are beyond thrilled with how it has worked out. Truly, if there was a city council meeting that would make you proud to be a part of our community, last night was it. Between our discussions about communication with our community as far as liaisons and having more community engagement employees to the Lucky Ones discussion and social equity discussion, we are moving a long ways, I think, in really trying to do a better job of embracing our community. And it was truly a wonderful conversation about Lucky Ones and all that Taylor and Katie have accomplished.
Yeah, and there was some discussion, and it does fit in really well with the social equity efforts that are underway. And there was some discussion by council that they were worried that possibly creating jobs specifically for individuals may, may be a difficult thing, and how to proceed with that in an open and, transparent way.
Yeah, so we have really embraced what the Lucky Ones have done and are now looking within the city municipal services to see if there are opportunities for us to provide differently abled people with jobs. And the thing is that there is such a range of abilities and strengths among this population in our community that there's some different opinions as to how we approach it, but I think we're all in agreement that there are lots of opportunities. Some people have very strong computer skills and are very technically minded. Some people are very friendly. So, there's just a range of strengths that we can really look to and embrace and find in different departments opportunities for these people. And so I think that it's really kind of looking inward and seeing where those opportunities really lie.
Okay, and what are the next steps around that then? Are each of the department managers looking at where the possibilities fall?
Exactly, and they are supposed to report back, I believe, to Diane, and they'll have a meeting. And then we also need to work with the parents, because the parents of these individuals really are aware of their children's strengths and where they might fit well and can really help us work out a program that will meet their needs and where they'll be successful. That's the goal, is really to create success and integrate people into our community where it works.
Yeah, yeah. So also, what's happening with the lease where the Lucky Ones coffee shop is? Is that all squared away?
Yeah, so we didn't actually negotiate the lease, but we just wanted to take a look and see how everything was going, because they are not paying rent for that space. We're subsidizing the rent in order for them to provide this service. And I think that everything is looking really good. They are operating, I believe they said that they're making twice as much, as if not almost three times as much, as the last provider in that space. And it's become a successful operation, and they're employing 12 to 18 people in that coffee shop that would not otherwise have jobs in this community. So it's really working out well.
Okay, great. Now, the other half of the people that showed up, it sounds like they were there really to talk about the city's resolution to reach net zero by 2022 and the overall community by 2030. What's new here that came out of this?
Well, so originally it was for the community by 2032, and we're pushing it back 2 years. So we're making our goal even more aggressive. And again, if there was a meeting that would make you proud to be a part of this community, this is another part of that whole amazing community feeling. We had such great feedback from our community that are telling us to go ahead and push it. And we're hearing from our sustainability department that they feel comfortable pushing it and that really we need to do this, that with the reports that have come out recently from our federal government and from different groups of scientists, that there is an urgency that is only growing greater. And we have a real opportunity to lead amongst ski towns and to provide an example for different ways that we can reach our goals and become a truly net zero carbon neutral community. And it was great hearing from, we heard from business entrepreneurs with ideas how we can reach our goal. We heard from ranchers. I learned a new word, herbivory, which is when you have animals eat plants, I guess, and grazing.
Herbivory?
Herbivory. We're all going to use it in a sentence today. But yeah. It was truly, again, we heard from a large contingent of our community that we're all for it and are very supportive of us pushing ourselves to reach this goal.
Yeah, so about a half a dozen people commented about suggestions regarding composting and recycling. We obviously have a lot of food waste in this mm-hmm. in this town, in this community. Where are we on that? Is that part of the program?
We have a lot more that we can do in our community, but recycling and composting and waste management really falls to the county. So we have some opportunities to reach out to the county and see if there is more that we can do with them. And then I believe Philip from Wild Harvest spoke last night, and he does composting. He has a private business where he picks up from different residences and businesses in town. And so there are different opportunities coming up in town.
Okay, great. And then there was also a forest advisory board formed with the California wildfires, of course, that's pretty fresh in our minds. Can this board have persuasion to, you know, get people to make defensible space around their homes? And
it is an advisory board, but they are reorganizing right now and beginning to work, have a more structured technical board so that they can provide advice to the community and work with us on having a better plan and start to enforce some of the regulations that are in the community already as far as the wildland urban interface. And really it's more about enforcing some of the things that are already in place and taking a greater look at where we need to make some progress. But yeah, we are very aware of the wildfires and what's going on in California and across Colorado. And we do live in an area where it is very much a wildland urban interface, and we want to make sure that we are doing all we can to protect our community and to be proactive for whatever may come.
So there is city code already in place that requires defensible space for property owners?
And I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I do know that, you know, you are supposed to keep your trees trimmed back from your house and some other things, but I would have to take a look at the code to be more specific.
Okay. And Steve Joyce, he said that the board might have an impact on new construction, possibly, mm-hmm. But that obviously we're practically built out. So, you know, maybe homes that are already abutting the mountainside should be carefully looked at.
Yeah, and so that's, again, it's going to take some revision of our LMC and taking a look at some of our code to be able to go back and retroactively enforce some of these policies that have come along over the last few years. And so I'm the Forest Management Group has its work cut out for it, but we're very glad that they're taking this proactive stance and starting to really take a look at what we need to be doing to protect our community.
And who is on the group?
It is a mix of planning, our trails, open space, building enforcement, and I'm sure I'm missing someone, but it's members of a bunch of different departments from the city that will have to be taking a look at how we use our land.
Okay, we'll get updates on that.
Exactly.
So the council discussed personal mobility devices, e-scooters, and decided they want to explore setting up policies for that, but it sounds like it's maybe not so urgent, although it is in the county. They sort of put in place a code that would control a little bit of that e-scooter traffic in the event that it did come into the community. Where are we on that?
Well, so right now they are prohibited within Park City. We have our Summit County Bike Share program that is allowed, but they would have to cut any of those business, you know, this is the e-scooters or the e-bikes that are the dockless ones, like the Lime, or I think there's one called Bird that you see in other communities. But they would have to ask permission to come into the city, and if they just showed up, we would be able to take them out, because it isn't, they aren't prohibited to operate right now. But there could potentially be opportunities for them to solve some issues for us in the future, and done well and done right. And if we can take a look at what other communities that are using them wisely have done, maybe there's an opportunity for them here in the future. We want to take a look at it and explore the possibilities and see what it would really mean to us before we make any decisions about absolutely for or absolutely against, or how we'd like to manage something like that should the opportunity arise.
Okay. So you're going to be working on that.
Exactly.
So you also discussed finally the customer service administrator position.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. One of the things that we know is important and that we've heard from our community is that people want to know what's going on and know what's coming up and that's going to impact them. And that goes from everything from big construction projects to special events. And it really does take a full-time person pretty much to have their boots on the ground, going door to door, talking to people, letting them know what's going on, reaching out to different groups in our town. And so we felt the need to bring on an additional person to be that community engagement person. And then at the same time, we also have heard loud and clear from our community that they feel like going through the planning and building process can be very confusing. And there's, you know, sometimes you hear from different from planning something that's different from what building says. And we understand that it's hard, and we want to make it a better process. So we are going to invest some development fees and create a position that will help kind of be a liaison for someone trying to work their way through the process, and will be an advocate for them between the planning and the building department and help them work it out, and can also help us recognize where we have issues. So we're really excited about these new positions. And like I said, it was just an awesome meeting last night where everyone should really be proud of the community they live in. It was so great to hear from so many people about things that are important to them and where we're going.
Thanks, Becca.
And can I add one more thing?
Yes,
that
please.
Everyone should go to Lucky Ones and drink their coffee. And they have some great new Lucky Ones labeled bags, I think like an empowering espresso and a full life light roast. And so we'd love to send some support their way for the Christmas holidays. And we hope that the community continues to embrace this awesome coffee shop.
Thank you very much, Becca. Appreciate you coming in. Well, this is the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guest is Jason Robinson. He is the statewide Upland Game Coordinator. He is on the phone to tell us about that upland creature, the rabbit. My personal observations, Jason, in the past couple years is that there are a lot of rabbits, especially the really big ones in areas like Round Valley, which are kind of scrubby, dry terrain. And I am hoping to hear a little bit about the populations and that kind of thing, and just some of the habitat and actions that these rabbits go through as the seasons change. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here to talk about rabbits. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so is it my imagination as far as the populations? Many of the people I know that use the trails, they're commenting as well that the number of rabbits out there are just kind of staggering.
Yeah, rabbits and hares are pretty interesting. They have a population cycle, so their populations will go up really super high and then crash down pretty low, and it's pretty cyclic, and we can often predict that. It occurs about every 10 years. What's interesting about what's going on, you know, in the Park City area is it's actually bucking the trend. So you probably have like a local population there that's doing really well, because statewide we've actually seen we're kind of in the down part of that population cycle. We do some surveys for cottontails and jackrabbits throughout the state, and we're seeing that statewide we're actually down in the number of rabbits right now.
Yeah. So what are the rabbits that we see up here? The rabbits and hares. You talked with me earlier about the white-tailed jackrabbits, which are the really big ones.
Yeah. And so Utah has three species of rabbit, which would be the mountain and desert cottontails and pygmy rabbits, and then we also have three species of hares. There's the black-tailed jackrabbit, the white-tailed jackrabbit, and the snowshoe hare. The ones that it sounds like folks are seeing up in the Park City area are what are called white-tailed jackrabbits, and they're really fascinating a rabbit. They're actually the largest rabbit we have here in the state of Utah, and they're unique in that they change colors. So they're brown in the summer, white in the winter. Snowshoe hares also do that, but snowshoe hares are quite a bit smaller and live in really thick conifer habitats.
Okay, and so what about is there a culling hunting season that goes on with rabbits in Utah?
There is, yeah. So there's a hunting season for cottontail rabbits of the two species, as well as snowshoe hares. So those three have hunting season. Pygmy rabbits are not hunted at all anywhere in the state. And then the white-tailed and black-tailed jackrabbits are what are defined as unprotected wildlife here in the state of Utah. And so they also can be hunted throughout the year.
So when the rabbits, the ones that change color in the fall, what makes that color change happen? It's not necessarily that snow falls. Is it a change in light and yeah. weather conditions? Or
exactly. Yeah, so the photo period or how long the day is what really triggers that in most animals, and white-tailed jackrabbits are the same. And so it's not uncommon if you have a late winter to see white rabbits running around with no snow. So they've actually turned color before the snow fell. But it's pretty fun to see them. And you know, the white-tailed jackrabbits, because they're so large, they really stand out, have really large ears, long legs. And so if they're white on the dark background, they really stand out.
Yeah, how big do they get?
They can be anywhere from 6 to 10 pounds. So for a rabbit, that's very large.
Yeah. Do the rabbits in this area attract other, bigger animals like cougar and coyote and that kind of thing?
They can, yeah. So most rabbits are, they're prey for a lot of other predators. And so, you know, they start out, rabbits, you know, were born pretty small. They're very prolific, so there's a lot of them. And so they're actually a very important prey species for a whole bunch of predators. Both mammalian, you know, foxes, coyotes, that kind of thing, but also very important for raptors, hawks, owls, and that kind of thing.
Okay. Anything else you think listeners would want to know about rabbits and hares going as far as in Utah right now?
No, I just go out and enjoy seeing them. They're pretty fun to watch and very, very unique, and learn the different species. We've got 6 here in the state of Utah, all very unique.
Can people go online to the DWR website and find photos and pictures of what the differences are between them?
They can. Yeah, we've got some information on wildlife.utah.gov on both all the different species, including distribution maps, where they occur in the state, some of the habitats that they use, that kind of thing.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Jason. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Bye now. Well, my next guests are Terry Orr. She's from the Park City Institute, and she's here with Hillary Nelson. She's a mountain climber and adventurer, and she'll be performing this evening with the National Geographic Live program on the Eccles stage. And I guess Hillary is going to tell us a little bit about the show, Down to Nothing, including the adventure where she and her team were pushing boundaries to the point where the excursion was near to a disaster. So welcome. Thanks for coming, Hillary and Terry.
Thanks for having me.
So, Hillary, in October, you attempted to lead an exhibition to scale, help me with the pronunciation,
Hakakabo Razi. And just to be clear, this was a few years ago, in October a few years ago, so not just this last
month. Okay, October 2014, yeah.
Yeah.
And this peak is in Myanmar.
Yes.
And it is part of the Himalayas. So they didn't go as planned, according to some of the press information I've received.
Right.
Now there is a documentary about the expedition. Tell us a little bit about the whole event.
Well, it was a trip funded primarily by a National Geographic grant. And the idea was to climb this peak. It's incredibly remote. There was really no information on it. It had only been summited once before by a Japanese man in 1996, and he had since passed away climbing Mount Everest, and so we had no resource for information, no photos. And the idea was to climb this super remote peak and measure its height because it's known as the highest peak in Southeast Asia. And there's other sort of competing mountains around it. And without a real accurate GPS measurement, we, you know, for me, it was sort of a geographical mystery along with my climbing partner, Mark Jenkins. And basically, we spent about 2 years planning the expedition. And from day one, just everything went awry and went a little crazy, including team dynamics, food, weather. I mean, you name it.
Yeah, what stands out the most? I mean, how did you cope with some of these things that came by?
Well, I think that's sort of the foundation of the story, is that we eventually didn't cope. Things fell apart to that extent. So one of the things that stands out the most for me is that you have a bunch of really highly capable alpine climbers going to a big mountain, but what really threw us for a loop was just getting to base camp. It took about a month to get to base camp, and we had to walk about 150 miles through a jungle to get there. And then again, after our experience on the mountain, we had to, you know, retrace our steps out of the jungle. And that was really an environment unfamiliar to any of us, and just proved challenging both mentally and physically.
And had you not really had a chance to anticipate that?
We anticipated it. We definitely knew that that was what we were going to undertake, but knowing in theory and the reality being very different was where a lot of the issues came up.
And were your routes, were they defined, or did you have to sort of create those yourself as you went through?
That was another huge challenge in terms, well, going through the jungle, we were at the mercy of the porters and the guide that we were with. And obviously the communication, the English language wasn't a good way to communicate. And then once we were up on the mountain, we had this expectation that, oh, we were in our world and we got this. And I think we underestimated what was in front of us. And mostly, in large part, that was because there was no direct route. There was nothing laid out for us. And so we were trying to figure this all out while we were doing it.
Yeah. So the mountain itself is not even 20,000 feet.
No.
And your team had been on the what you call the 8,000 meter
yes.
club, or which
so,
are 30,000
yeah, I mean,
foot
among
peaks.
Our team, one of which was Renan Ozturk, who lives locally, Corey Richards, Mark Jenkins, Emily Harrington, Taylor Reese also lives here. She was our base camp manager. And, you know, between that group, we must have had, we had over 100 expeditions under our belt. Every single one of us had been on 8,000 meter peaks, some of us multiple times. And so, you know, it was very easy for us to say, oh, well, it's not, I mean, it's not even a 20,000 foot peak. We got this. This is going to be easy. So, I mean, originally our plan was to climb all three of the peaks that were in question as far as height. Mm. And I mean, we suffered on just one. It was really, we bit off a lot more than we thought we were going to bite off.
So just to get kind of a location on it, where does it sit in the Himalayas?
So it's the very eastern end of the Himalayas, and they actually go through the very northern tip of Myanmar, which I honestly really didn't quite realize that until we started doing the research and figuring it out. But it's the eastern tail of the Himalaya. So it separates between the high Tibetan plateau on the north side and the low Burmese jungle on the south side.
And were there weather effects because of its location that were surprising?
Yes. So that was a huge factor in what unfolded as we got higher on the mountain, because despite blue skies, we had crazy winds and incredibly cold temperatures because of our timing. It was sort of the changing of the seasons. And, you know, the low Burmese jungle was sucking the cold air off the Tibetan plateau, and it created incredibly forceful and scary winds on this whole ridge that we were climbing on.
Well, I get the feeling, Terry, that this presentation on this evening's presentation is going to be a little raw and extreme.
<Yes. laughs>
Have you had a chance to see it?
Well, no. This is
this is
the
for
first,
you too.
So
okay.
It'll be great to have it on the stage. And you know, I think a lot of us, myself included, are lifelong fans of National Geographic, and we would look at those beautiful pictures and we'd see those extraordinary things. And there'd be a story in print that was flat on the page, and while that was pretty entertaining, the fact to have an explorer with us and to be able to tell firsthand, there will be plenty of stuff on the screen to look at as well, but to have Hillary there is pretty exciting.
Yeah. So what will the evening encompass? I mean, there'll be a question and answer session or?
Yeah. I mean, I will say, just to back up a little bit, the imagery is absolutely incredible. You had Corey Richards, who's a National Geographic photographer, and then Renan Ozturk, who's won multiple awards for his ability to just capture raw emotion and cinematography. So that is one of the more incredible parts of the presentation, is just seeing those images. And then, yeah, I'll leave it up to you for how it rolls out on stage.
So there will be a Q&A afterwards, mm-hmm. that will be...
Right. Which is one of my favorite parts. I like the Q&A.
Not for hours, you know.
No,
yeah.
But of course not.
Smart Q&A afterwards. But really, yeah. This is Hillary's presentation, both her telling her story and us seeing that story on stage.
Right. And it will be mixed media. So I'll be talking the whole time, and you'll have still photography and then moments of, you know, snippets of video and sort of intermixed along with the story.
So one of the comments I think you made in the paper had to do with you being a mom and thinking that you could manage this team like a mom would manage.
Yes.
And I thought that was really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it didn't work out that great. to start, there's certain places where mothering is very effective and other places where it is not. I think there were so many challenges to our team dynamics, and each and every one of us was trying different ways to effectively communicate. And eventually I pulled out that one in hopes of, you know, I really have this fault, if you will, in terms of leadership, of always wanting to make everyone happy. And that just doesn't always work. And that is one of the challenges I'll definitely talk about tonight.
Okay. Have you done any big projects like this since 2014?
I have. Honestly, I was so destroyed, would probably be a good word, after this expedition, that I took about a year off. And then in late 2015, and there are multiple reasons for that, not just this expedition, but in late 2015, I kind of got back on the horse again and went on a big climb with Emily Harrington, who was also on this trip. And then since then, I've been going quite a bit and having a lot of success back in the mountains. And I attribute that to a lot of the things I learned in Myanmar.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Anything else you want to say about tonight's
presentation? The show starts at 7:30. There are tickets available either by going online or calling the box office. And for this show, all the tickets in the theater are $29. So you can just get there and find a seat. And it's a little different than how we have the rest of the season. So yes, it's snowy outside, but we know how to get through that. And if we can certainly make the effort to get in our car and get over to the Eccles Center if she made the effort to climb the mountain.
Yeah, that's right. Don't let that. Oh, we don't let snow keep us at home here.
Well, I
no,
hope not.
Snow is a reason to go outside.
Exactly. We're playing in this. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks.
That's
for having
Hillary
me.
Nelson.
Thank you.
Mountaineer, adventurer, mother.
Yes.
And Terry Orr.
Thank you.
From the Park City Institute. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.